Coming up on this week's episode of TechSnap. We sell your private internet browsing history to the highest bidder. Wait, no, that's your ISPs. We cover the latest rollbacks of U.S. internet privacy regulations. Plus, the surprisingly uplifting story of script kiddies getting their day in court. And Dan does a not-so-deep dive, this time, into ZFS and lets us all know why we should already be using it. Plus, it's your feedback, a ridiculous roundup, and so much more on this week's episode of TechSnap. Welcome to this week's episode of TechSnap, Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly systems, network, and administration podcast. This episode was streamed live on March 28th, 2017, and is brought to you by our three excellent sponsors, DigitalOcean, Ting, and IX Systems. My name is Wes, and joining me this week, hey, and every week, he's our favorite host. He's the admin, the explainer, and the organizer. It's Dan. Welcome back to the show, Dan.
Hello, everybody. Here we are. How's it going?
It's going wonderfully. How are you this week?
Good.
Anything new to share with us?
Yes.
Oh, you know how you know that always makes me happy.
New cargo pants.
So are you going to like get up and spin for us? Let us see everything?
Duluth Trading Fire Hose Pants.
That sounds very practical.
They are very good. My last pair lasted about nearly 3 years.
Oh, wow. Hey, that's pretty good.
And that's probably wearing 100, 200 times a year.
That's awesome. So is that kind of part of your uniform, if you will?
Yeah, it basically has enough pockets to carry everything I need every day, like wallet, cell phone, glasses, spare battery.
The everyday carry. It's nice to have. It's nice to have storage if you don't have a bag or whatever.
Yeah. What else? We previously talked about me migrating off my Nagios into external and internal.
Right, yeah. That was a big split up.
I asked Mark Felder the other day to give me... Oh, it's so terrible. I keep mixing up surnames and IRC handles.
Yeah, that can be pretty confusing when they're not the same.
Mark gave me a jail on one of his boxes, and I was able to implement my separate Nagios panel for public-facing services. When I say public versus private services, is that intuitive?
I mean, do you just mean like if they are facing, they have like publicly addressable IPs? Is it for like services that you can query over the public internet versus things that you access only internally?
Yeah, that's okay. So it's stuff that I can monitor from third-party systems.
Right.
So the system I'm monitoring from is not part of my infrastructure, so I want to be able to see what the public sees.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm monitoring what the public sees, but not necessarily what the public uses.
Mm.
Because some of it's private mail servers and stuff like that, but it still can be seen on the public internet.
Right.
And so anything that requires SN, MPD, or NRPE will be internal.
Yeah, that would make sense.
We'll be at home and we'll...
But things that are already trusted or already exposed to the internet, that's external.
Yeah, so like it'll check that that port 80 is up and running, but the internal stuff will verify that it's Nginx is running or Apache that's running. It'll check to make sure that the PID number in the file matches the process.
Yeah, that PID is actually running, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Yes. I had to reboot a Nagios instance earlier today. That web UI said it was running and everything looked good, but no PID file, but no PID. So that can definitely be a concern.
I had a lot of trouble getting it working at one point because, you know, when you don't set up the CGI right, it tries to download the script.
Yes. Like, you didn't execute that. You did not execute that.
Downloading the script, What? It's set up right. Check again. Yeah, it's set up. Look for somebody else's website. How did they do it? Oh, yeah, it's set up that way. Download the script. Let's try another browser. Oh, look, Nagios is running. Thank you very much, Carl.
What are you using for the CGI layer with Nginx?
I'm running it off Apache.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So for Mark also suggests that I start using Nginx and PFM? FPM?
Yeah, that does sound familiar. I've used another one like FCGI wrap or something.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
Not something I've done extensively. I usually end up deploying Python things or other, but...
It would be something I'd like to do, but, well...
I mean, if Apache's working, and what's your load really like, so...
Yeah, it's not much. It's not extreme. Even, you know, we're talking about a Nagios web server that's behind HTTPS and auth, so nobody can see it unless they authorize first. So the only person that loads it is me.
There you go.
So it loads every what?
Apache works great.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, that...
And it's just easy to set up.
Yes, exactly. And there's a lot of benefit there. Well, that's pretty neat. I look forward to hearing more about how you use it.
Oh, one more thing.
Yeah.
As we speak now, no hands involved, the FreeBSD Diary website, or more correctly, the server that it runs on, is moving from, I think, New York State to New Jersey.
Oh, hey. Why? What for? New colo? Better hosting?
It's long been hosted by New York Internet.
Okay.
And they're moving it from an old site to a new site.
Nice.
And originally, I thought I was going to have to renumber all the IP addresses, but they found a way that I didn't have to do that.
Excellent. So that's a lot easier.
All I'm doing is...
Is it just some downtime while they move it?
Yeah.
That's easy.
Okay, sorry. That's the last new thing.
No, I like it. Thank you very much for the updates. I'll I don't use a lot of Nagios myself. At work, I definitely do. So I'll be curious to see how this how your Nagios setup goes in the future.
We can talk about Nagios later on.
There we go.
Let's talk if you want. Excellent. We can get into that.
Huh. But first, we have much more depression. We have a good show, an excellent show. We talk about your privacy. We talk about ZFS, everyone's favorites. Your feedback and awesome. The roundup looks great. But first, some depressing breaking news. Lay it on everyone, Dan.
Yep. This is depressing. Now, what bothers me about this is, unfortunately, a lot of what we're going to talk about in this section of the show is US-centric. But I'm sure everyone can relate. So earlier this week, the Senate passed a bill that sort of let ISPs sell your private stuff. And that's a big pain in the ass. So I was thinking, well, no, this won't get past the House. And I was hoping it wouldn't get past the House. But it did. It got past the House today. But... it was earlier this week, and my notes aren't showing, that a private internet access, a VPN provider, took out a full-page ad in the New York Times. How much does that cost, you know?
That's a load
of money.
Yeah, that's a spendy thing.
Yeah. And they called out the 50 senators who passed this law. I thought that was pretty poopy. For lack of a better word.
Yes, I like that. I like that a lot. I don't use them, but I definitely know some people who do use them. They seem like a fairly reputable VPN company. So it's nice to see that clearly it's in their business interest to do this, but it does speak that you know, they care about this issue too.
Yep, I agree. Now, so the next thing that happened is I got this story already earlier today, knowing that the vote was happening, and I was going to encourage people to contact their representatives and tell them, no, don't do this. This is ridiculous. But now I just read that the House just voted to wipe out all of that. So basically, overwhelming margin, 215 to 205, which isn't, that's only 10 people. You only had to change the minds of 5 people to prevent this. So I'll be interested to see the list of who voted what on this.
Yes, definitely.
Now, sticking with that of who voted what, There is a link in the show notes showing you who voted what on that bill. And there were 50 yeas and 48 nays, and two did not vote. And the two that did not vote were from Georgia and Kentucky. Now, what you can do is use this page to scroll down, and you can see the states, and you can see your representative there. And if you're really worried about it, there's another page, the next page. Where was it? Who represents me? Did I include that in the web page?
Yes, you did. Here we are.
Who represents you? Yeah, thank you. So go in there, fill in your zip code, your address or whatever, and it'll tell you who represents you.
There we go. That's easy peasy.
Click on there. Can you get phone numbers?
Let's look. Okay, let's see, Patty Murray. Let's find out more about you. Yep, phone number, website, and address if you want to send mail.
Call that phone number. Forget the email. Call that number. Tell them that what just got passed was incredibly stupid, invasive, and is going to cause all kinds of problems for people in the very near future. Basically, people get pissed off now when they check for an ad on something and then that ad follows around for weeks. Now imagine if your ISP has that information. They know exactly what websites you've been to, exactly for how long, and what you've been looking at. They are now able to sell that information. There's a bunch of discussion about, you know, opt-in and opt-out, but let's be honest, the ISPs are in this for the money. They're seeing the money that Google makes and that from advertising, and they think they can do the same thing. But they're mistaken, because people freely give this information to Google in exchange for benefits that they get from the tools that Google provides.
That's a great point, right? Like, you understand that that's part of the deal is you help fuel their you know, advertising network, and you get, you're already in a contractual agreement paying a monthly bill, most likely, to these ISP things. So, yikes.
And so now they want to use information, data that you're not actually providing, but they just happen to be able to see. And what are you going to get out of it?
Yeah, nothing. Right. Nothing. I mean, I guess they would say maybe you would get like what AT&T was doing, right? Like, say that you'll get better targeted ads or those kinds of things, more relevant to your interests, which, yeah, maybe that's true. But at what cost? And if I don't have if I'm not allowed to, you know, agree or give my consent or anything.
Mm-hmm. Where do I say that the ad's relevant to
I get to inform you?
Yes.
Can I give you feedback on your pull request on your algorithm for scraping my data? That's really too bad.
So there's another post here about five ways that cyber security will suffer because of this. It says if Congress repeals the FCC privacy rules, well, they have, and it will become law once the president signs it. Don't know when it goes into effect, but you see, the ISPs and the advertising consortiums are in this together. They are actively lobbying the legislators to do this. And in fact, I was reading earlier today that the politician who actually introduced this bill received a lot of funding from ISPs. No conflict of interest there whatsoever.
No, not at all.
None.
Yeah, so, it seems like a very strange case from that perspective. It really just kind of seems anti-consumer in many ways, anti-privacy. Yes, I can see the business case for that, but there's already been, you know, ISPs that have done something like, hey, you get cheaper internet if you agree to give us this information or other things. So clearly there are ways for the market to deal with this without this kind of change.
Now, AT&T tried this. I read that today, too. AT&T tried this. They say, we will give you a non-intrusive, ad-free browsing experience if you pay an extra $23 a month. And it died. No one...
Right.
It was incredibly objectionable. So it's just absolutely ridiculous. When you pass a law, at least you've got to keep in mind, who does it benefit?
Yeah, right, exactly.
This does not benefit your constituents at all. It benefits businesses in your constituencies. And we know which constituencies we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's really hard to see this as a way that's good for society at large in really any way.
I can't imagine anyone who is not involved with an ISP or advertising that thinks this is a good move.
Yeah.
If the ISPs are allowed to sell this data, all of us should be able to buy the browsing data of the politicians that signed this, that voted for this.
Now that's an idea I like. Can we spin up some sort of advertising company here and start getting that data?
There will be a rider in here that it's not valid for politicians.
Yes, of course.
They'll be exempt, much
like
they're
exempt. Isn't that just how it usually works?
Yes. Why are we not getting health care like they get?
An excellent question.
So, risk number one that this article talks about is snooping on traffic. Now, let me move this over here so I'm looking more into the camera. This is a little bit better. So, in order for internet providers to make money off your browsing history, they first have to collect that information. What you're browsing, metadata from who, stuff like that. But they haven't been exactly bastions of security when it comes to keeping that data private. So there's going to be break-ins. This information is going to be stolen. We already know the data that's collected gets stolen. It happened. We talk about that here all the time. Remember the fuzzy little warm animals?
Oh, yeah, my favorite little cloud pet. Nothing ever happened bad with that.
No. Millions of people's... The information from millions of people was stolen there. Now, if ISPs are going to collecting this, they're going to say, no, we're going to be very good and we're going to be very secure. No, you have nothing to worry about. That's absolute bullshit. If you collect this data, it will get stolen. Won't be stolen, all of them, but it will get stolen.
And that just underscores, too, like it's just having it sitting there, having it available, not necessarily making it in the ISP's direct business interest, especially when you already have to subscribe to them for internet in the first place to keep it safe. And then it really just has it ripe for abuse. It's just waiting to be taken advantage of.
If I was being forced to vote on this and being forced to let it pass through, I would ensure that there is heavy fines on a per-person basis for any information that was released.
You heard it here first. Vote Dan for Senate.
If your database gets hacked and private information is released, private identifiable information, then the company in question is subject to huge fines multiplied by the number of people whose personal information has been released. So say, let's call it $40,000 an incident. 100 people get exposed. What's that? Is that 4 million or 40 million? I can't do the math. 40,000 times 400,000. Yeah, that's 4 million.
There we go.
So who was it? Was it Bruce Schneider that said basically it's in banks' financial interest to make sure that funds don't disappear, but it's not in their financial interest to make sure that your privacy is protected. So they put a lot of work into making sure that the money doesn't go missing, but they don't care about your personal data.
And it's really important to understand those kinds of relationships, right? Because that's really what governs them as an organization, and same here with ISPs.
Time and money and security gets spent on the things that are important to the people spending the money. And it's not important to an ISP to maintain your privacy.
No.
Not at all. There's no incentive for them to do that. Their incentive is to gather as much information as they can because they're going to be selling that on to other people. And yeah, they're going to be collecting information about what medicines you're looking at.
Really any way that they can make additional revenue without having to, you know, build more lines, lay more fiber, or increase their costs.
Now, to that end, why does it cost me about $90 a month for a 75 meg up down line from Verizon plus HDTV when I hear about people that are getting 2 meg lines of fiber to their apartment in Paris.
Yeah. Really makes us feel backwards, doesn't it?
75 meg versus a 2 gig line.
I'm jealous of that.
I think it was a 2 gig line. Maybe it was a 2 meg line. I may be wrong.
Okay, well, that would be a whole different story.
Yeah, that would be not good. 2 meg line, yeah, sorry.
You have to report back maybe next week. We can do TechSnap from France.
It was one of my coworkers, so I'll have to check with him.
Excellent. All right, is there anything else good here in this 5 ways?
Erasing encryption and making it easier for hackers to spy on you. Right now, they can only spy on that portion of the encryption, that portion of your traffic that is not encrypted. So if you're going to HTTPS sites all the time, they can see which site you're going to, but they can't see which URL you're looking at or what you've downloaded, anything like that. So it is highly incentivizing for them to break HTTPS because they don't want you to use HTTPS because that doesn't give them the metadata that you want. So they're going to be highly motivated to break encryption. How many times have we seen politicians saying end-to-end encryption is not good? Yeah, Don't do it.
Yeah, it's just not tenable in their eyes.
So the next logical step, and I agree with this, is they're not going to get much money if you're using VPN or Tor or HTTPS. They want you to use none of those. So I wouldn't be surprised if they start encouraging that.
Yeah. And we might see similar things, right, where, you know, if you do more, you know, hey, you're unencrypted traffic to video sites. Yep, well, you will, you don't pay for that, or it doesn't count against your data bill. Sure. So there's a lot of techniques there that can incentivize them the wrong way.
Have you ever typed a URL into your browser and it's wound up that you've got the domain name wrong?
Yes.
And so it's a non-existent domain and it brings back a page from your ISP.
I hate that. Yes.
Hey, listen, that doesn't exist, but all of these other things
do. Here's some search results and some ads that, give us money. Yeah. Just click there.
No, don't do that.
Yeah, no, I
don't do that.
That's particularly egregious and common for subject. Oh, yeah, you should probably change your DNS servers.
So this leads to number 3, inserting ads into your browsing. Why wouldn't they? They're in the ad business now. They're your ISP. They can manipulate everything coming down from you. So that'll be the next thing. The ISPs will say, hey, listen, because we're doing all these ad things, can we just, you know, like insert an ad into the web page you're looking at? And the politicians will say, oh, yeah, sure, there's nothing wrong with that. Who are they getting their technical advice for when this bill is passed? I'm sure they took no technical advice whatsoever and just listened to the ISPs and the advertising consortiums. I'm disgusted by this.
Yeah, it'd be nice if there was some sort of council of general people involved in, you know, people and technologists and tech companies involved with this, because obviously I'm sure the Google and other advertisers are less than pleased about this.
Well, Google, it can be easily argued, is
also an ISP, yeah, so they're not biased. A great example.
Oh, no. They're a little bit, it could be argued that they're biased and they're objecting to this because it's cutting into their business.
Right, yeah.
But now, number 4, zombie super cookies. They already do this. Well, Verizon did
Verizon.
It a couple of years
ago. Didn't AT&T do it for a while as well?
I don't know. I don't see it mentioned here, but I do see Verizon. But I am familiar with this, and I have seen it happen. And now they have all the incentive in the world to do this because, you know, they'll put it on your laptop, you'll go somewhere else, and you'll be using a different ISP, and they say, oh, he's over here now. Oh, is that where he goes for lunch?
It really is. Okay. I mean, when you think about it like that, there's a lot of information you can get very easily, very powerful. And then suddenly, right, like, I mean, now you're just those 2 rows in a database somewhere and you're correlated.
Mm-hmm. Spyware. Internet providers pre-installing spyware on our devices, particularly mobile phones. We talked about this last week or the week before. Didn't we talk about malware that it came and pre-installed on phones somewhere between the manufacturer?
Yes, we did.
And the retailer? Yeah. So, you buy a a hotspot. Surprise, it's going to inject little ads into you every now and then because, you know, not only is it a hotspot, but it's also sending information.
You're really making me sad here today, Dan.
So I like the last paragraph in here. The net result is simple. This repeal of the FCC's privacy rules won't just be a disaster for Americans' privacy. It will be a disaster for America's cybersecurity too. So there is nothing good to come of this.
No.
Please, everyone, call your politicians, tell them what an asinine thing they have done, and ask them how they're going to make it better. Because this is absolutely ridiculous. Ask them if your politician is willing to send them their browser history right now of every one of their devices. They won't do it, but they feel it's fine
for
you.
It's entirely fine for us to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just disgusted.
All right. Well, that brings us kind of to the next article here. What can we do as an end user, as someone subject to this, is there anything we can do to mitigate it?
Yep. I've lost it. Show me the top of the article.
Oh, there
we go. Let's go there. There we are. That one. Yes. So how we can do this, I've lost it. There it is. So a VPN can help, but it's not the ideal thing because then you have to trust the VPN user, the VPN supplier. But then eventually, you know, at the end point, it's going to come out somewhere anywhere. So do you trust your VPN provider or do you trust your ISP? And I can see there now being a huge market for VPNs, but a lot of services such as Netflix do not work over a VPN. It's none of my ISP's business that I happen to be looking at Netflix or Hulu or whatever, but they seem to think it's important to on-sell that information now. So a VPN can help, but it's not going to fix anything. It's not going to fix everything because unless you use the VPN for absolutely everything.
Yes. And it prevents a lot of usability issues and, you know, are you going to have an appliance in your home, like one of those little, you know, auto VPN router things? Mm-hmm. How do you get that into the hands of your average consumer?
Yep.
It's a problematic story, really.
So the only people that VPNs are going to help are the people who are knowledgeable and can do something about it.
Looking at you, audience.
But the majority of people are going to be subject to this.
Yeah.
And it's just not fair. It's not fair at all.
Yeah. I mean, like, you're even like, all right, well, what? So I have to set up special routing to make sure that, you know, only Netflix doesn't go through the VPN. And it's, yeah, that can be problematic. And then maybe you need other stuff for work or for other things that don't allow VPNs. Ugh.
Yep.
Will you be changing any of your browsing habits or upstream connection habits?
I'm going to wait and see what Verizon declares and then take action.
Is that your ISP?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. We'll have to keep
it. I'm going
to
wait.
Yeah.
I'm not going to change anything right now. I got too much other stuff to do.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So if we go to the next article, we can see where I said that AT&T used to charge extra for privacy. So in 2013, AT&T charged fiber internet customers at least $30 extra a month unless they opted into a system that scanned customers' internet traffic in order to deliver personalized ads. Now, it's interesting that they killed this internet preferences program shortly before the FCC finalized its privacy rules. But you see, as it goes on here, I was talking about this earlier. The ISP lobby groups have argued that privacy rules would prevent them from showing internet users more relevant advertising. Well, we don't want to see your advertising at all, so don't show it to us.
Yeah, you assumed we wanted that any advertising would be relevant to us. That was your mistake.
You are an internet service provider. you are not someone to sit there and throttle my traffic. You're not someone to sit there and present ads to me. You are there to deliver the traffic that I have paid you to deliver.
Exactly.
So just deliver it. Get good at that and stop wasting all your time on stuff that's not relevant to delivering me the traffic that I've paid for.
It's so frustrating from a, like, can you imagine at the business level, like if you were buying buying a trunk line somewhere or other, you know, like business to business ISP connection, they're like, oh yeah, we're just going to inject ads into everything that you're serving here. That would be, that would be crazy. And yet it's okay to do that to us as the end user.
To consumers. Consumers are okay.
Yeah. They don't know any better. They won't notice the difference. It's fine. Which, I mean, is probably sadly true, but does not make it right.
All I can think of is that politicians who voted for this should be forced to have every one of their phone calls conferenced in with a random constituent every time it occurs.
Every
one of your phone calls will be listened upon.
It's like a weird political chat roulette kind of thing. That's hilarious.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's lots of them on chat roulette.
Yeah, probably.
So what's even more disturbing, if you scroll down a little bit, it's up to ISPs to interpret the law. You know, the thing is, there's something called Section 222, but it isn't clear how this affects broadband providers. And I've forgotten what Section 222 is. There it is. So Section 222, it's right under ISPs want to be the advertising powerhouse. It's about one third of the way down. The FCC's reclassifications of ISPs removed FTC authority, but imposed privacy requirements from Title II, Section 222 of the Communications Act. The problem is that Section 222 was written in 1996 for telephone services, so the FCC said it would write new broadband-specific rules explaining exactly how Section 222 would be enforced on ISPs. Those rules, including the opt-in requirements, were finalized in 2016. So, theoretically, they could just return the jurisdiction to the FTC by eliminating the privacy rules and eliminating the ISP's common carrier classification. But even that might not work, because it said any company with a common carrier business cannot be regulated by the FTC at all. That was a ruling in August 2016, even when they're offering non-common carrier services. So the common carrier designation is also used for landline phone and mobile voice service. That means ISPs like AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint could be entirely exempt from FTC oversight. That's absolutely ridiculous. How can they be exempt? Just because they're a common carrier? If you're a common carrier, do the carrier. If you're involved in advertising, you're not a common carrier. If you're involved in producing and distributing content, you're not a common carrier.
Yep. I mean, it really kind of reminds me of some of the problems we've had with the financial industry, where we've had, you know, like more banks, and then these very like speculative investment banks kind of bundled into the same business. It's very similar here, where it's like the regulations maybe make sense in one light, but when this company is a hybrid, this classification really makes it hard to have effective laws. Interesting.
So, anyway, back down to here. So, the section on VPNs, Tor, and HTTPS is down below it's below that section you're on now. So, basically, this one sentence we sort of covered earlier. To protect your browsing history from your ISP, you need to encrypt your internet traffic, and there are three primary methods of accomplishing that. VPN services, Tor, and HTTPS. Have you ever used Tor?
I have. I mean, it's been a little while since I had it set up. I did have the Tor browser configured for a while. It's a really interesting from a theoretical point of view. I've not used it practically.
It's slow.
It is slow, yes. That is the thing. But I've had some friends who've run exit nodes before and some relays. So,
do you know why it's slow?
Not in a detailed way. Tell us more.
All right. So there's an exit node and there's an entry node. And in between, there's a whole lot of other nodes.
Right.
So you've done a trace route.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going from A to B, you're now going A into the Tor node, all the way around the Tor, and then coming out somewhere. Right. And the number of nodes you go through is not always set. It's not always a fixed number.
Right. And that way, even the exit node doesn't know where you came from next. They can see your traffic, but they don't necessarily know where it came from.
They don't know the origins.
Yeah.
And the key there is the reason it's slow is mostly because you're going through a lot of different systems.
It's a lot of extra latency to just add. Yep. And, yeah.
Just those systems is a lot of latency.
It's really neat that it works at all, though.
Yeah. If you really need that privacy, if you're doing something extraordinary, such as, what do we call it, rogue government employees?
Yeah, there you go. Yes, yep. Exactly. Journalists under fire. Anyone in a sensitive position.
And we're rooting for you.
Exactly.
We really are. So even with a VPN, if you're doing a VPN from home to another given place, that also introduces latency, but not quite as much.
Right.
It's not as severe. But Tor definitely increases it. So politicians may be dismissive and said, oh, no, anyone that really wants to be private can use Tor. Well, make them use Tor for a month and see how they like it. So it is good. It has its use, but I wouldn't use it every day. So this article finishes with, it's not too late to call your rep. Well, now it is too late. And I'm sad that I didn't get to this earlier, but I think we've gone on about this almost enough. What was it? And how to stop them? Yeah. I think we've gone on about this enough because...
Yep. I mean, I think we've made it clear.
It's getting me grumpy.
It's getting us both grumpy. It's probably getting the audience grumpy. It's frustrating to see these developments go exactly the way we don't want them to see, especially now that we've highlighted for you all the reasons this sucks. But there are some things you can do. Please do write, contact, call, make your representatives understand that this is not something that represents you or that agrees with you, and that it does have real ramifications for real people. And we can start seeing what we can do about it. In the meantime, that is an excellent reason to turn to our first sponsor today. That's Ting. Go on over to techsnap.ting.com. There you will find mobile that makes sense. And guess what? Ting understands your concerns about privacy. Ting, they're just like us. They're cord cutters. They're people who want to have data plans. They understand that, you know, in many cases, your cell phone has that important stuff that you need. So to support things like that, Ting does some awesome things. One, you can get started for only $6 a month. That's right, $6 a month. So if you just need a backup line, you need a private phone number you only use to call certain people, Ting is great for that. Or, hey, you want to have a, you know, you don't trust your immediate ISP, you want to get a couple layers of indirection, you need a connection that goes through Ting and then goes out to the public internet. $6 a month, then you just pay for what you use, your minutes, your megabytes, your messages. Probably, if you're like me, it's just going to be those megabytes. But Ting makes it so simple. Go over to techsnap.ting.com. That will get you a $25 service credit, my friends. Or maybe you don't have a phone. So that's one of the other things about Ting. You can bring your own phone. Just bring it. You see it right there, BYOD. Bring your own device. If you don't want to do that, go check out their shop. They got a lot of nice phones. They're unlocked. They don't get in the way of your updates. Hey, look at that. There's an event going on right now. Moto G5 pre-order event. You can get it right from Ting. That's right. It'll work on their GSM. It works on their CDMA. It's awesome. So really don't wait around. Don't get it stuck into a contract with one of these huge companies that are trying to track you. Ting has no interest in that. Ting just wants to sell you service that you can use at a price that you understand, where you pay for what you use. It's cell phone service for adults, for people who acknowledge, hey, yeah, I want a tether. I want three-way calling. I don't want to pay extra fees. Ting is the place for you. Oh, something happened. So go check out Ting. Go to techsnap.ting.com today. I think you'll be very pleased. And with that, let's go back to the TechSnap program. What do you have next for us, Dan?
Krebs.
Oh,
we like Krebs.
Krebs is our favorite.
We like Krebs.
We certainly do.
And this is good because at the risk of invoking DOS myself, there are some DOS folks, alleged DOS folks, ready to stand trial.
Yes, as Krebs has shown, it can be a dangerous topic to talk about, but we'll brave those waters.
And not just any DOS folks.
No.
We'll get to that later on. So it starts off with police in Israel are recommending that the state attorney's office indict and prosecute two 18-year-olds suspected of operating VDOS, until recently the most popular attack service for knocking websites offline. Two 18-year-olds.
Wow.
What two-word phrase comes to mind?
Two 18-year-olds. Script no. Kiddies.
I think this is a very embodiment of that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
So basically, this service had tens of thousands of paying customers and facilitated countless distributed denial of service.
Right, this is one of the larger DDoS for hire, DDoS as a service operations for a while there.
It was big.
Yeah.
It was lucrative. They earned a living at this.
That's crazy.
A living that many people could only dream of. And that's the part that I find atrocious.
Yeah, exactly.
So they ran these DDoS attacks over the 4-year period that it was in business. 4 years. So hold on. How old were they? 18? So 4 years in, they started this when they were 14? How much technical knowledge did they actually have?
It really makes you wonder. Yeah, what did it take to get this going? I mean, obviously they learned a lot to make it so successful, but still makes you wonder how much they understood or the scope of their and implications of their actions.
I'm sure I'm invoking their wrath at the moment. So anyway, on October 8th, Krebs on Security published a story about this group, and that story named two young Israelis as the likely owners and operators of VDOS. And within hours of its publication, the two were arrested by Israeli police, placed on house arrest for 10 days, and forbidden from using the internet for a month. That's a long time. So what's even more interesting is shortly, they were never charged. So this was September 2016, September, October, November, December, January, February, March. So only 5 months ago. So they weren't charged at that time. However, this week, Israeli police sent letters to lawyers for both men stating that the official investigation was nearing completion and they planned to urge government prosecutors to pursue criminal charges. Now, according to a story published Sunday by the Israeli news outlet TheMarker.com, the government of Sweden is also urging Israeli prosecutors to pursue formal charges.
Yeah, interesting.
It's unclear exactly why the Swedish government is interested, blah, 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 blah. Shortly after those attacks in March 2016, Somerville, Massachusetts-based intelligence firm Recorded Future published an analysis linking the assaults against Swedish media sites to VDOS and to Applejack, the hacker name allegedly used by one of those two Israelis. So, now if we scroll down here a little bit further, they allegedly started the VDOS when they were 14 years old. By the time it was shut down last September, it attracted tens of thousands of customers who paid for attacks in PayPal.
Wow.
When VDOS's PayPal accounts were shut down, the service briefly shifted to accepting Bitcoin. So Krebs says that his September 2016 investigation into the hacking of VDOS revealed that in just two of the 4 years the service is in operation, it brought in revenues of more than $600,000. That's $300,000 a year. That's $150,000 each. Not $300,000. $150,000 each for a kid under 18.
That's a nice salary. Wow.
And it's probably not the full income.
No, I'm sure not. Wow.
So
it's amazing how apparently lucrative this is.
But no good deed goes unpunished. Krebs and security paid a heavy price for breaking the story on VDOS's hacking and the subsequent arrest of its alleged proprietors. Less than 2 weeks after those stories were published in September 2016, this site came under one of the largest DDoS attacks the internet has ever witnessed. It was huge. I remember reading about it at the time, not thinking much of it because I was busy.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But yeah,
no, that, it was
that, made that made headlines.
And was covered on the prior invocation of this show.
It was. So, here's the kicker. Here's the defense. So, the lawyers have said that their clients were merely operating a defensive stressor service sold to companies that wished to test whether their sites could withstand large cyber attacks. I'd like to see that contract between them and Krebs. I'd like to see that. Find out what it's like. So, law enforcement officials, both in the U.S. and abroad, say stressor services enable illegal activity and that they've recently begun arresting both owners and users of those services. Well, it's one thing to stress your own sites, but I don't see anyone paying for that. Not at this magnitude.
Right. So, no, and certainly not. I mean, you would probably, that would probably be a package of, you know, you do your security audits and you do load testing. You probably can do load testing yourself or with your clients and yep. Not some sort of sketchy fly-by-night DDoS for hire service.
No. And they're just making a legal argument right, here.
Exactly. Some legal games we can play.
I'm sure the lawyers don't believe it.
No.
So, finally, one last point. In October 2016, the U.S. Justice Department arrested two 19-year-old men alleged to have operated a stressor service affiliated with the hacking group known as the Lizard Squad. I don't know them. Now, those of you that are listening, I urge you to go and read the comments on this, especially pay attention to Mike's question. How would 2FA have prevented any of this?
Yeah. That's pretty funny.
So Krebs, you know, engages him a couple of times and then he realizes it's not worth it. But there's a whole lot of stuff down through here talking about Mike. And basically, this is why you should not read comments on articles.
Yes, that's something we've learned well and true here at Jupiter Broadcasting.
Don't waste your time reading the comments.
Just stay away. All right. Well, anything else you'd like to comment on this story? It's definitely interesting to learn a little bit more about this kind of secretive and weird operation.
I can't see anyone defending these folks. I can't see anyone saying, okay, what they've done is not wrong. It's very different from someone who's, you know, look at some other people who have legitimately reported a service vulnerability and have been arrested and put in jail.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas,
This is not that. Yeah, I think you're right. It seems kind of unequivocal that what they're doing was taking advantage of other people attacking legitimate businesses for profit.
Yep. We don't like them. We'll take them out.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, then, if this has put you in the entrepreneurial spirit, you should find out about our next sponsor. That's DigitalOcean. My friends, DigitalOcean, they are the simple cloud hosting provider that's dedicated to making it easy for you, easy and intuitive, to spin up a cloud server of your dreams. So just go on over, DigitalOcean.com. We've got a promo code. Yeah, that's right, promo code SNAPOcean. That gets you a $10 credit. And wait till you find out that DigitalOcean, why, they've got a droplet that starts at just $5. A month. Yeah, that's right. $5 a month. Go over to their pricing page. There they've got this very handy, it's simple, it's transparent. You can click on the monthly prices. So, you know, hey, I just need a month of this, or I want to know what's it going to cost me monthly, or maybe, and this is, gets a little cloudy here, guys, you can get hourly prices. So if you just need to spin up a droplet, I like this 6 cents an hour one over there, 4 gigs of memory, 2 cores, 60 gig SSD disk, 4 terabytes of transfer. And that's not those, you know, oh yeah, you can use up to 4 terabytes, but your speeds are so slow, you'll never do it. No. DigitalOcean's got 40 gigabit E right to the KVM hypervisors. They know what they're doing. They're using industry-leading technology. That's what makes them such an awesome cloud provider. They've got data center locations in New York, San Francisco, Singapore, Amsterdam, London, Toronto, Frankfurt, and I'm sure more coming soon. So whether you want it to be the endpoint of a little VPN you run yourself, you want to start a startup and DigitalOcean can be there as your first run of hosting provider, they can do anything you'd like. They'll scale with you. They've got awesome things like they've got load balancers now, a monitoring program in beta. They've got redundant, attachable cloud storage, SSD back that you can just add and move between droplets. They've got private networking. If you're in the same data center and you have 2 nodes, you don't pay for that. Makes it really easy if you want to run backups, send ZFS snapshots, all kinds of things. So don't waste any more time. Don't use some bargain basement VPS provider that doesn't give you real virtualization. Just go over to DigitalOcean.com. Use our promo code SNAPOcean, all one word, SNAPOcean. That'll get you a $10 credit and on your way to spinning up the droplet of your dreams. Woohoo. Do you have any DigitalOcean droplets over there, Mr. Dan?
Yep.
Nice.
I have a long-time website, a website that I used to look after for years and years and years. They sold the business and wanted to keep the email running. And so it's now running in a $20 a month DigitalOcean droplet.
Nice.
Or maybe 10. I'm not sure. It's one of the two.
Yeah.
It's running ZFS, which people may think weird. Why are you running ZFS in a virtual environment? I said, because it does.
It's still totally useful.
Checksum.
Yeah, you get checksums.
I can snapshot. I can roll back.
Even if you're not necessarily doing it for like the raw block, you know, attached to real block devices, performance, and all the other things of ZFS, there's still a lot of stuff that is worthwhile.
It is wonderful.
So I guess that's
the best thing since sliced bread.
I guess that's a natural segue into the next topic of the top of the show here.
Isn't that interesting?
How does that work? I have no idea.
I don't know who did that. So since I first started off these notes, I've decided to misappropriate Alan Jude's slides from VBSCon 2015. And I was at this talk, and I'm going to go through it mainly because I really like what he's done with it. But most of this is just me briefly rambling about some of the things that I like about ZFS. Have I ever talked about ZFS before? Have I ever mentioned it? Like that it's a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about it a little bit, but really only in passing. We haven't dedicated some serious time yet.
So this isn't going to be a lot of time. This is just going to be enough to get people interested who have never heard about it, never used it, never tried it. So the key thing is and when you're reading the show notes, don't read it in isolation. You have to be listening to what I'm saying now. Otherwise, everything is very general. And I'm sure people will say, oh, no, that's not exactly how it's like. It's like this. And I say, well, yeah. But we're keeping things very general and high level, and I hope I'm not misleading anyone. And there's a lot more to learn about it. So do your own investigation as well as what I'm doing. This is just a teaser, just to get you started. So I think that ZFS is a great lifesaver for sysadmins. I think it has so many impressive features that make day-to-day administration of systems much less stressful. I can give you a great example. A friend of mine, Mark, whose name we can't remember, was developing a version of Subversion for a strain of Linux which no longer had packages available. And we wanted a version of Subversion with a more recent OpenSSL for obvious reasons. But we didn't have the benefits of the FreeBSD packaging system. We had to build this from source. And when we were building OpenSSL, well, he was building it. I was just listening. when you built OpenSSL, it installed to base. In other words, it overwrote the stuff that was in slash bin, slash sbin, stuff like that. The problem with that is you only got to do that once. Because once you've overwritten your base OS, it's crap. So if you have to redo it again, you got to reinstall. But because Mark was using a jail, all he had to, a jail on a ZFS FreeBSD system, all he had to do was roll back. And all those changes, all those horrible things that, that the make install had done were gone. And he could keep doing that until he got it right. And that's just one thing, the snapshots. Now people will say, yeah, you can get snapshots on other file systems. Well, yes, you can. But don't judge it in isolation. Judge ZFS based on all the other things you get. Now, the easiest way to think of ZFS is you put a whole bunch of disks together and there's your bucket. And it draws from all of those drives and gives you your disk space. Now, that doesn't mean you have 2 1-terabyte drives and suddenly it presents to you something that looks like a 2-terabyte drive, because that's what is commonly referred to as striping. And if one of those drives dies, they're both useless because the information that you've been writing to them has been put half on one and half on the other. And a stripe has no redundancy. One element of the VDEV dies, and we'll talk about VDEVs in a second, and you're gone. The beauty of ZFS is that it can do at the software level what is usually done at the hardware level, and that is redundancy. You've all heard about RAID, which is a redundant array of independent disks, or lately has been inexpensive disks. And that's the key when it comes to ZFS, is you can use commodity hardware. You can use consumer grade hardware and get an incredibly reliable, robust system that people used to spend thousands and thousands of dollars upon not that long ago. And now we can get that in a desktop machine, like just stuff you can buy from the local computer store.
Right. You don't need to go buy like a super high-end, fancy, proprietary RAID controller. You can use awesome open-source, open ZFS.
Mm-hmm. And any special stuff that you might need, you can get on eBay secondhand, and they're very reliable.
There you go.
By that, I mean the HBAs, the host, is it host bus adapters?
Yeah, I think
the
so.
Things you plug all the drives in.
Yeah, exactly. You gotta get everything connected. But once you're there...
Like one thing that you can use and that the FreeNAS folks recommend is a bunch of M1015s, IBM M1015s, okay, or the LSI 92 thing type things. I've got a bunch of them. I have several that are unused. Nice. If anyone wants to buy them secondhand. In fact, I seem to recall offering someone on the FreeBSD project one of these secondhand, and I never got back to them.
So maybe if you're nice, he'll even autograph it.
I can autograph the card.
Yeah.
So VDEVs. You put two drives together into a VDEV, and that's your VDEV. That's a simple way of thinking about what a VDEV does. But the beauty is, if you have two drives, you can make a mirror. And if one of the hard drives dies, your system still keeps running because it's running off the other drive. And when you replace that other drive, chances are you'll have to power it off to do that. But when you replace that other drive and it comes back up, you can say, hey, here's a new drive, use it. And it just copies all the data over from the other drive and you're back up and running. And you say, I remember a computer shop owner. I was describing to him what RAID was. And I said, well, here's a mirror. Think of it that way. And he says, well, hold on. You've doubled the number of drives, so haven't you now doubled your chance of having a hardware failure? No, that's not how it works. What you've done is you've halved, we're getting into probabilities here.
It's
but
true.
The reason you have two drives is so that if you do encounter a hardware failure, you can still keep working. And at your leisure, you can go and get another drive.
Right. It's like you have to, you really have to realize you're not concerned about the individual drives anymore. And that's what the system abstraction lets you do, is consider the whole operational state of the entire system.
Exactly. You know how Google's most intricate code is designed not to cater for failure, but basically to accept that failure is going to occur and just keep working anyway. It doesn't matter that something has died.
Exactly.
You get it somewhere else.
I think I heard something once about that. Like, I mean, if you have a fleet of 10,000 machines, the chance that all 10,000 at any one time are all operating correctly is just basically zero. You got to design around that. Same with drives.
Yep. So let's say you've created this big ZFS RAID array. You've bought 3 hard drives and put them all together. Doesn't matter what way you've done it, just as long as you haven't done a stripe, because if you really like your data, you won't do a stripe. So once you've got it all there and you want to create different file systems, say you want to give one of your roommates some disk space and your other roommate some disk space, but a third roommate is very hoggish and they keep filling up the drive. So what you can do is you can give that hoggish roommate a quota and say, okay, you do a ZFS create hoggish and then set a quota on that and say you can never go over this size. So in effect, you've created a virtual hard drive that has a set limit on it. So it's like you've given them their own hard drive. That's not exactly what they see, but that's an easy analogy to look at. You can do other things like turn M time off. Sorry, A time. You want to turn access time off. Why? Because every time a file is read, it causes another update to the file system.
You know, that's something I've run into, especially if you're using jails or other containers, and maybe you're doing a lot of, I've run in dpackage or apt. That's something that ZFS made really easy. I could just turn that off, as well as some other optimizations that in other file systems, you might have to go to further lengths to make sure that, do less fsyncs, do less file touching, all that stuff. ZFS makes it super easy to configure.
You can turn on compression. Yeah. You can turn on different levels, different types of compression, different algorithms, different compression depths. I know that the volumes that I use for Postgres has a different record size. I know that the volumes that I use for my backups have a very large record size. Can't remember what it was. Excuse me, I can't even remember the maximum record size. But all of these little fine-tuning things that you can do is just, it's really impressive. And the best thing that I can say about it is try it and use it for a little while. It may be confusing at first, but if you ever need to write a script for it, all the parameters are scriptable. It's not like you have to invoke some crazy command line thing. Like, you can literally say ZFS create big data / WES, and boom, there's a file system mounted and ready to go. You can then start writing to it. There, you're done.
Yep. And it's nice how it does that, how it kind of changes the way you think about the abstractions. And suddenly you can deal with all of your hardware, and then you're at the online software level, and suddenly you can, you don't need to worry about partitions. Mm-hmm. You don't have to use something like LVM and then have a file system that's not aware that it's on that. Everything becomes first class.
Mm-hmm. You said partitions. Yeah. You don't have to worry about partitions.
Isn't that great?
In FreeBSD, you create a partition on the disk for ZFS. I think it was SunOS or LumOS, you just give the whole disk to ZFS,
right,
but in FreeBSD, you give a partition. And so what I often do is give it not the whole partition. If I'm using the whole disk, I don't partition the whole disk, because if it comes time to replace that drive, it might be a sector or two smaller. So I save a few meg or gig at the end of the drive just in case. But yeah, you get three drives, put them together all in a mirror. You've just got one big space to put all your data. And if you want to create /var/temp/var/log, you can put different restrictions on those. You can say, okay, /temp can't grow any bigger than this. You can give someone a home directory and say, okay, they can use as much space as you want. Or you can say that, okay, on this file system, you must always have 50 gig free. Why? Because every night I dump the database and it's 50 gig in size. So you always have to have 50 gig free.
It's kind of an administrator's best friend in that regard. It makes it very flexible to make, you know, runtime. Yep. You've already configured the system, but oh, wait, yeah, we really need to redo how that works. Mm-hmm. Easy peasy. No new image, no new, none of that.
And that's not even getting into snapshots and ZFS send receive to send the stuff copy over on the write. Internet. Because it's a copy on write, because it doesn't overwrite the old data, it always does a copy. It means that if you take a snapshot and then send that to another system, and then you want to update the remote system with everything that's happened, it sends only the changed data. So if you changed 10 bytes within a 20 gig file, it doesn't send the whole 20 gigs of the file.
Right.
It just finds that little block that changed and sends that.
Right. And my understanding is that it just only sends any blocks that have a birth time after.
Right.
Which that's awesome. It's just so much more efficient. It's a sensible way to do things. It also plays really nicely if you're using jails or running other sorts of containers or other things. It makes it really easy. You can share all the files for your base thing and then just have different views or, hey, you know, this one, we want to update all the base things. This guy needs a special application. This needs a different one. You don't have to duplicate everything below.
Yep. And sometimes what I do in jails is I give a certain directory within the jail its own ZFS file system so that then that can be snapshotted separately and backed up.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Like my mail directory, maildir, that gets a separate directory. I know I've done it a couple other times, but I can't think of where. Sometimes you have a certain directory and you want it to be very, very fast. So I mount a file system from an SSD.
Very nice. Yes, that makes sense.
So you've got hard drive, and then in the middle of it, you've got a little SSD that's from another.
Right.
It's just like a secret mount that's in there, and it's completely transparent to the users.
So in that same vein, I mean, and ZFS also has a lot of things you can use SSDs for as well. Like if, you know, it's amazing how many features they've really considered things, whether you're using it just on your own machine, your laptop, your home system, your NAS, all the way up to, hey, we have petabytes of data that we need to store.
And one last point, some people sometimes say, I only have one hard drive in my system. What uses ZFS? And the answer to that is snapshots. And what is it? Checksums.
Checksums, very important.
When it writes data, it does a checksum of the data it wrote, and it stores that there. When it goes to read it back, it does a checksum of the data and then compares it to what it was when it written it. And if it's not the same, it tells you, and it says, the data got changed. And if there's another copy of the data, it fixes it. But if there isn't, well, at least you know the data changed.
Yeah, and even with one hard drive, that also opens up a lot of things that, Bmin, the boot environment system. So you can update your system, and then if things don't work out, you can boot right back into the previous version. So that can make really anyone who's worried about that, or you want to have unattended upgrades, really makes things a lot safer.
I'm going to upgrade. Save this copy away. Okay, let me upgrade. Okay, boot from this. Boot up. Oh, it doesn't work. Okay, boot that other thing, please. Oh, okay, I'm back where I started. Exactly where you started
from. You know, people today might be familiar with like AWS snapshots and those kind of things, except that's super slow. ZFS already has it, and it's instant, or at least way faster.
Yep.
All right, well, anything else you'd like to add about this marvelous file system?
If ZFS is available on your operating system of choice, try it. If it's not, try another OS.
Yeah. I would like to say I use it very regularly on Linux. ZFS on Linux has come a long way. It works very reliably. If you're on the latest Ubuntu, They compile the driver for you. You just apt-get install ZFS. It works very nicely. Ubuntu has some good documentation. The FreeBSD handbook is awesome if you need advice, even if you're not using FreeBSD.
Alan wrote some of that.
Yes, he did. Look at that. I was going to show that. Our good friend, Mr. Alan Jude, helping everyone out by updating the docs. Excellent. All right. Anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Okay. Well, that very naturally brings us into our last sponsor this evening. We love ZFS. They love ZFS. That's right. I'm talking about you-know-who, IX Systems. They are awesome friends. They make hardware we drool over every week, running amazing Intel processors. Yeah, that's right. You like Intel processors? So do they. That's why all their servers ship with the latest and greatest Intel processors. So go on over to ixsystems.com/techsnap. There, you will find the ultimate guide for buying a new server for open source. IX Systems has been around. They know open source. They know the internet. I mean, the server will work for closed source, too. If that's your thing, they make beautiful servers. The best servers. So just go check them out today. Whether you're interested in a new server for work, you know, you're talking to people who you need some new rigs, the latest and greatest hardware, you have some performance issues that you want to get solved, or, hey, you just got, you know, you heard us talking about ZFS, you want some of that for yourself, go on over to ixsystems.com, check out their free NAS Mini. That is one of the easiest ways to get started with ZFS in your house, getting all those benefits that we were talking about, snapshots, checksums, maybe you want to use zVols for your virtual machines. That is all possible. And IX Systems contributes to the open source development. They help support OpenZFS, which is the upstream project running the open source ZFS. FreeNAS is open source. They support TrueOS, which is their desktop operating system. It's a really great, you can tell they support the community, that this is something that's important to them just as much as it's important to us. So if that doesn't get you excited enough, go check out their blog. They always have interesting stuff there. Here's their latest post. TrueNAS Storage Primer on ZFS for data storage professionals. You can see that they really recognize that OpenZFS is the premier file system for data integrity, data reliability. That's why they trust it. That's why they build appliances based on it. And that's why we love that they're one of our sponsors. So if you're getting the runaround from your current hardware provider, you have sluggish support, you have support reps that don't know what they're talking about, have to get back to you, take too long, you just don't trust, or continued hardware problems without the support that you think that you deserve, just stop. Don't waste your time. Call up IX Systems. They have an awesome team of talented sales engineers. Emphasis on engineers here. They want to work with you. They want to help you get the server that meets your need. They understand that your server should be custom because you have a particular problem that needs to be solved, whether you're running a new database server, you need a monster new, huge RAM, awesome, special CPU server, you know, for your brand new business. It doesn't matter. IX Systems wants to work with you. So don't waste any time. Go get a new server from ixsystems.com today. Go to ixsystems.com/techsnap. That lets them know that you appreciate them sponsoring the TechSnap program. That brings us to this week's feedback, where we reach deep into the mailbag of mystery, pull out our favorite feedback items from you guys, and we talk about it. So, this week, we've had a little bit of a change. The format may look different, but it's the same feedback from our same favorite audience. Up first, we've got a letter from Jake about dealing with waste heat. Good morning. Thanks for the show. You're very welcome. Dan, I'm curious about how you deal with all the heat your rack, your wonderful rack, let me just editorialize here, all the waste heat that your rack produces in the summer. I myself have up to 4 desktop computers running as various servers and routers. Right now they're in a closet, and we just avoid opening the door as much as possible. Stay away from the closet. What I'd like to do is relocate most of the machines to my garage. The trouble is that the garage is not air-conditioned. I'd like to place the machines in a small cabinet to avoid paying for air conditioning in an entire 10x10 room. My question, does anybody make a small, energy-efficient air conditioner just big enough to cool the inside of a wardrobe-sized cabinet? Or is there a better way to deal with the heat? Jake. Thank you very much for writing us, Jake. What do you think, Dan? It seems like, I mean, firstly, we don't know where Jake lives, so that may change things. But it seems like you deal with it pretty well.
This is the current temperature in my studio.
There you go, 82 degrees.
And that's with having the door closed for a while. Right. So, first suggestion, a small window-mounted air conditioner may be cheaper than you think. And for a 10 by 10 room, it may be enough for what you need, because a lot of people run an AC all year long, just cooling down one room. That said, if you want to keep using your closet, I've seen a lot of stuff on Reddit about venting just one closet. Now, it all depends on your architecture, but maybe you might be able to vent it somewhere a lot better than just that room, and at least keep the cool air, keep the hot air exhausted. Even just a fan on the ceiling, like cut a hole, vent it up. I don't know if what's above. If it's the attic, you may be in luck. But if it's not, you're out of luck. But what about the walls? Can you vent there somewhere?
Yeah, see if your neighbors don't mind. Just give them your waste heat. Yep.
You can always buy fully enclosed racks and then mount, buy a small portable AC and have it vent into the rack space. You may even be able to buy a full height rack and put the AC unit in the bottom of the rack. You've got how many? What was it? Four desktop computers. So yeah, they could fit in a rack and still have room at the bottom for your AC unit if you got that type of a rack. Even if you bought a regular rack, you could easily build something with scrap timber and even just a thick polyethylene, not polyethylene, but you know what I mean? The Dexter plastic.
Yeah, no,
that might work.
That seems like there's a number of opportunities there.
Get onto Reddit and go into the Home Lab Reddit.
Oh yeah, that's a great subreddit.
And ask in there. A lot of people have done this already. A lot of people, very knowledgeable. What it tends to be there is people who use big hardware at home and then have hardware at home, big hardware at work and then have hardware at home as well. So ask there. You may not have to do anything in the garage to keep it cool. Tell us what your temperatures in the garage get to, because usually a garage is cooler than the outside, so you may be okay. And even just having window open. The other thing is you may want to invest in very good air filters. You'll find a link in the show notes for a company in South Africa that builds custom air filters and standard air filters. They're really good. I've got some of them on some of these machines at the back. They're not so good for rack mount hardware, but they're very good for desktops. Don't let the fact that they're shipping from overseas put you off. I've gotten very good service from them.
I like this website. Stop the number one computer killer.
Yes.
But hey, they come very, very highly recommended there.
I remember posting on Reddit and saying, look at these great air filters. And people said, I think you should stop paying money on air filters and find out why your house is so dusty. if you had an air filter, you'd know how dusty your house was.
Yeah. So that's one thing I might say to Jake too is, I don't know how long you've had that little thermometer there, but perhaps investing in some metrics, you know, be able to track how much heat you do get, how it changes after you've moved things, might help you answer your questions.
What was the temperature before?
82 something.
82 something, because it's now exactly
82. I think it was 82.2 before.
Yeah, well, it's going down fast.
Is that too warm for you? Is that okay? Are you kind of a warmer person?
I'm sitting in a t-shirt.
Ah, yeah, that's true.
T-shirt and Duluth Trading cargo pants.
That's right. What temperature do you keep the rest of your home, if I may ask?
It's unheated.
Oh, okay.
This heats the entire apartment.
See, so that's another. Long. It's almost like, you know, instead of a wood stove, you have your rack. So
I don't pay for heating in winter. The far end of the apartment will get rather cool in winter when the temperature goes down below freezing. It does get rather cool, yeah. And I live in a part of Pennsylvania where we get snow. Pardon. We get snow, but it doesn't necessarily stay.
Yeah.
The average daytime high is just above freezing. So.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not that bad.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like there's a lot of options there for Jake.
Yeah. So, and so, yeah, what do I do? In the summer, I often work out in the living room rather than in here. This will be my first summer with this rack, but I have a feeling that I'm putting out less BTUs than I was before. So it may not be as uncomfortable, but it probably will get up to 80 or 90 in here easily if I don't have the AC on. There's an AC vent right up there, and I try and keep the blinds closed. I try to open up the windows when everything you normally do to keep the place cool. So
that makes sense. Yeah. If it works for your house in the summer, it'll probably work when you have a rack in your garage.
And yeah, I'm saving money in winter heating, but having to spend a little more money
on cooling.
July and August, yeah. Like 2 weeks of July, most of August. That's when my AC is the most. But that's the only time I use AC or heating.
Nice. That's very reasonable. All right. Well, hopefully that helped you, Jake. Please write back into us and let us know how it works out and what you end up deciding to do and how hot things get. That brings us to our next piece of feedback today. Caleb writes into us. He's wondering about Postgres and MySQL. Hey, Dan and Wes. Love the show. You've both done a great job filling big shoes. They are indeed big shoes. Thank you very much, Caleb. I'd like to follow up on Dan's strong expressed preference for Postgres over MySQL. I'm not all that familiar with the advantages Postgres might have over MySQL. I've used both MySQL and MariaDB as a backend RDBMS for hosting a few small projects where they were the default or recommended option. But I am curious if I would be better off using Postgres given the option. Thanks, Caleb. I have seen that myself, you know, a lot of things that just start out, hey, this is what we use, MySQL, yeah. MariaDB. So it may be very helpful here, especially, you know, I'd be curious as well where you see, you know, which particular areas, what workloads Postgres may be particularly advantaged to.
Well, if you're just running a website and there's not a lot of traffic and it's read-only, sure, use MySQL if you really have to. I have, I think, 4 WordPress websites. They all run Postgres. Not by choice, but because that's what's supported. You can do they all run MySQL. Not by choice, but that's because what WordPress supports. They do have a Postgres solution, but it's unsupported, unmaintained, and no, I'm not going to do that. So it's running WordPress, but again, that's mostly read-only. If you're doing stuff like I was doing back in 2000, I think it was February of 2000, I was creating a website called Freshports, and I started MySQL. I wrote a post about it. You'll find it in the show notes. And then by September or January, I had switched to Postgres because my background was using stuff like DB2, Sybase, I can't remember the other stuff. That's my show notes that are gone. And so I was used to having things like stored procedures and functions and data integrity, like foreign keys and primary keys. And MySQL didn't have all of that 17 years ago. 17? Yeah. Wait, is that right? 2010? 7? Oh, yeah, 2000. Yeah, no, it's 17 years ago. It was January 2000. And then by September 2000, I swapped over to Postgres. And I swapped over because the database that I was writing for Freshports needed stored procedures. It needed functions. It needed relational integrity. And I wasn't getting that from MySQL. Now, people will point and say, well, MySQL has that now. And I say, well, it's about time it has it. But there's a lot of other funky things that MySQL does very funny. And you can easily search for MySQL versus Postgres, so I'm not going to go into that. But I will say that the Postgres development team does a lot of very stringent analysis of any changes they're about to do. And they are very particular about protecting your data. It is my database of choice. And if you're putting anything into it that's important, anything transactional, anything that you're doing huge queries on, do Postgres. You'll be much happier. Now, in that same vein, if you have an application that does a file open, consider using SQLite instead of a straight text file. Use SQLite. It'll make your life a lot easier.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. And frequently, especially if you're only using something for personal use, if it's a very simple application, SQLite can be more than what you need. Don't even bother with MySQL or Postgres. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to scale it up, you're going to have real users, production.
Yeah.
Don't. But, you know, if you're just running like I think I am actually using Postgres for my Quassel server, but for a long time it was on SQLite, and that worked just fine.
Never use Quassel.
Well, it
almost did.
Yeah.
It's IRC, right?
Yes, but it's got the front end back end split. So instead of having a bouncer, you have a front end and connect with the client.
Well, I've got the front end, which is textual.
Okay.
An OS X IRC client. And my back end is ZNC.
Yes. I've not used that one, but I've heard many things about it.
So ZNC is what actually connects.
Right. It does
all your IRC.
Yeah. Stays present and sends you updates, all that stuff.
Yep.
Excellent. Okay. Well, anything else you'd like to add there for Caleb?
Use Postgres. You'd be much happier.
Short, simple, sweet, succinct. Yeah. I like that a lot. It plays well. You know, there's a lot of projects that use it or rely on it. There's also a lot of people that use it for myriad things. They've got all the JSONB support and other things, so you can use it kind of like a NoSQL type database for some applications. It's very flexible. It might work for your workload and is really worth probably looking at as a first option. And that brings us to this week's rather ridiculous roundup. We've sure got a lot packed in here today, Dan. I mean, that's a good thing and a bad thing. We have to go a little quick, but there's a lot of awesome stories for folks to reflect on.
Well, this first one I found interesting because it's the first thing I've read that sort of talked about jails and containers in the same breath. And now I sort of understand a bit more about containers. Mm-hmm. I know someone who's doing a lot of day-to-day work on containers, and I asked for their opinion on this. And they said, yeah, it's pretty accurate, but I can't comment upon jails. But that's okay. I can comment.
We've got you, yeah.
So have a read of Jesse's article here about VMs versus jails versus Solaris zones versus containers. And you can't really compare them because they are totally different things. And the point that gets made first is that where it is. A container is just a term people use to describe a combination of Linux namespaces and C groups. Linux names and C groups are first class objects. They are not containers. So basically, it's this combination of tools put together is what they're calling a container. It's not a jail. It's not a VM, stuff like that. So if you go over all this list of stuff that she says that you can do and not do with containers and jails, there you go. Now, the one thing she does talk about is complexity equals bugs. And she says, this extra complexity leads to bugs that lead to container escapes. Don't get me wrong. You could also escape a VM, a jail, or a zone, but the design is not as complicated as that as the primitives that make up containers. Less is more, and the less complexity you have, the less likely you will have odd edge case bugs. So it's pretty hard to get out of a jail. I can't comment on VMs or zones.
I mean, you do occasionally see VM exploit bugs, so it's definitely possible, right? But you're right.
You don't hear it. There's very few about jails, and jails have been around for about at least 10 or 11 years. And if Paul Henningkamp is listening, which I doubt he is,
but he should be.
He will correct us.
Yes, exactly. No, I like this article a lot. Jesse's obviously very smart and talented lady. And I think it is good to understand, you know, that there are different design principles. I don't know if you can say there's design goals for containers necessarily as a you know, subset of different concepts. But I think she's also right to point out that there is some utility, and that when you think about it different, it can help you understand how to leverage. Like there are a lot of times I'll just use, you know, on Linux, I'll just use a network namespace, for instance. I don't need all the other kinds of isolation. That's all I want. Yeah.
Well, I need to learn more about this desire and flexibility and control that they mentioned below. And I need to learn more about Linux namespaces because I can't comment on it.
Well, I think that'll be definitely a topic we could do a deep dive or at least just a section on in the future. That might be fun.
Yep. Here's what I learned about namespaces. Here's how you can correct me.
I watched TechSnap and all I got was this talk about
namespaces. I don't watch TechSnap anymore.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, since we're jam-packed, on to the next article.
On to the next. Now, this one, Drew Levine first posted this, but I saw it posted by other URL as well, but this is very funny. So basically, a dishwasher has a directory traversal bug. So basically, it has an HTTP interface, and you can do this simple little fetch and get the shadow password file.
Oh, my gosh. Just like wow.
That. Just like that. That is a very basic vulnerability.
Yeah, that's really basic. Funny. It's still crazy. I don't hate IoT. I'm not trying to be a naysayer, but it's still weird when you see things like this and you're like, a dishwasher? A dishwasher? But I could also see like maybe I want my dishwasher to send me an email when it's done or something. I don't really, but maybe someone wants that. But this is totally just like an argument for this is why you want VLANs or some sort of network isolation for your weird IoT devices.
To be honest, this is not a household dishwasher. This is a commercial level washer and disinfector. So it's not something you're going to have in your kitchen, despite some of the photographs that have accompanied this.
Yes. Yeah, no, that is an important distinction. And that's where it might make sense that you want an interface to be able to control it or that sort of thing. So.
Yep.
But when you have something like that, got to get your security right.
Pay for it.
So, speaking of security and vulnerabilities,
mm-hmm.
Our next article, Apple says it fixed CIA vulnerabilities years ago.
Yep.
Interesting.
It's as if they knew. So we covered the CIA stuff, I think twice, once in brief and then once more in depth. And basically this post is just saying that Apple has already fixed all this stuff. The iPhone attack was described in January 2009, a full 6 months before the iPhone 3G was replaced. So the MacBooks were described in documents dated up through 2013 and described models current up through the middle of that year. And so it seems to all have been fixed already. So we said at the time that this stuff is not really... Was it this stuff that we said that the average person doesn't have to worry about it because these are all very targeted espionage as opposed to mass surveillance?
Yes. Yeah, that was.
So it is something to worry about, but don't stress your life out over it.
Yes. A different threat level here, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah. It also kind of reminds me, it seems like they're usually a little bit ahead of the curve, or at least competing well, like when there was all that issue about like when the authorities wanted to unlock that iPhone, and it what they had done would not have worked on the latest generation of iPhone, where it has the separate security processor and enclosure or whatever. So it's interesting to see this development and their continued, say what you will about business practices, about their design, about their products at all, but they clearly take their customer security seriously.
Yes.
Okay, so in the opposite vein, if you don't take your customer's data security or you just had an accident, Troy Hunt's got some advice here about what to do after you failed. I like that. That's a good title.
And Troy Hunt has some experience in stuff that has failed. He did the Cloud Pets. He did. So he has some experience on seeing what happens when people fail. So everyone who has data that is publicly accessible or not, as the case should be, have a read of this, have a read of it now, have a read of it before you need it, because when you need it, it's too late. You got to have a plan in effect before it happens and follow that plan.
Just like with most disaster, DRC, that sort of thing. You know, if you don't have your playbook ready, in a panic, you'll make mistakes.
Yep.
Thank
you, Troy.
Yes, thank you very much. A wonderful source and doing good research and writing. So on to the next bit of our rockin' roundup. You've probably heard about this. LastPass has had a browser extension security flaw. Looks like they are releasing the fixes, though.
Yeah, but right after it was announced, there's another problem found right away. And I didn't know this, but this is with the browser extension. So somehow your passwords are in your browser plugin or extension or whatever. And I just think that's a bad idea. I wouldn't put my password anywhere near where the browser can get at it.
Right, like they probably download the password vault.
I like having it. I want it over here in a separate app. I want my password manager to be completely separate from my browser.
Yeah, I have few enough accounts that I kind of feel the same way. The convenience factor is not a huge deal for me. I prefer to know that, like, yes, I have to take the password from here and put it over there, and never the two shall meet otherwise.
And I have to type in my master password, I'm going to guess, 50 times a day.
Yeah.
And I have to type my sudo password maybe 20 to 40 times a day.
Yeah, totally.
If not that. So yeah, I don't keep it in the browsers. Browsers are well known for not doing
the secure thing. It's a big, complicated environment that's hard to sandbox and hard to, you know... Especially things like extensions, where it really straddles that line of, like, you're not a web page, but you're not the browser runtime itself. What's happening?
The only thing I can think of is it must be for convenience, so that it automatically fills in the passwords for you. No, don't do that.
Yeah. Or we need to do it in a better way, where there's a, you know, like an open and documented protocol that we can audit the security of the connection, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to work either.
Yeah, probably won't. Okay, so speaking of not working.
Yes.
This I was kind of glad to see, because... Well,
you're just getting the segues so good today.
I'm trying. Practice makes perfect. So, Google takes semantic to the woodshed, as R says, for misissuing 30,000 HTTPS certificates. Yep.
And I like that it does have a picture of a woodshed.
I like that too.
This is nice. So... Yeah, basically, Symantec has done a bunch of bad stuff with issuing of certificates, and they're not doing the right things, and they're not making sure that the certificates they're issuing are for the right people. So Google's stopping recognizing them and will eventually nullify all those certs that were poorly issued. Actually, I haven't read this whole thing. I scanned it briefly, but basically, Google says 30,000 certificates. Symantec says, no, it can't be that many. No, it's 127. No, it's not 30,000, it's 127. I'm more tempted to believe Google here.
Yeah, I don't think Symantec has shown that we should really be trusting them in this regard, especially when they've prior shown really, I think, what amounts to negligence. So, good on Google. It's nice to see them having the pressure and using it.
When you make a mistake, admit it, fix it, and move on. Yep. Then it goes away. Just don't mess up.
Maybe they can go read that Troy Hunt article and learn a few things. That might help them out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's next? What's next on the roundup?
We're gonna finish with two happy stories.
Yay! Thank you. I like that. Maybe we should make this a theme.
This next story is from Slashdot, but it's about a British teenager who contacted scientists at NASA to point out an error in a set of their own data. Basically, what happened is there are these detectors on the International Space Station, and when nothing was hitting them, it was returning a negative number. But you can't have negative energy. So he told them what was wrong, and someone fixed it. But they originally thought it was only happening once or twice a year, but he found that it was happening multiple times a day. So there's a link here to a video. The video is really cool. Listen to it. But good on this 17-year-old for finding it. NASA invited him in to help. This has got to be so great for his career. That's awesome.
You're right. This is a very happy story. And, oh.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see that kind of involvement, right, where, like, the public can look at this stuff and give feedback and give improvements, especially in times of constrained government spending on science and other things. This is great.
Yep.
Okay, so what's the final item this week?
The final item is that time I trolled the entire internet.
Oh, I like the sounds of this.
So this is someone who jokingly created a website called netauthority.org and started sending fake emails out to people alleging that it is recently brought to our attention that you have been or are in violation of the Net Authority Acceptable Internet Usage Guidelines. It has been reported that you distributed, read offensive materials over the internet, and they gave them a list of things to do. So blah, 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 blah. And then it just took off one day. He couldn't get into the website, and he got his cell phone was ringing from numbers he didn't recognize, and it basically took off. And it's pretty funny. This is back around 2000,
2001. One of these classic kind of internet, not war story, but something along those lines of, it was a different time back then.
Yes. So I want to read the entire post, but I didn't have time today. But it does sound very funny.
Excellent. Well, thank you for including it in the roundup. I think that's great. Anything else you'd like to add to today's show?
Nope. But if you have questions, write in.
Yes, please do. We love it. It makes us smile. And obviously, we need more of that. All right. Well, that wraps up this week's program, this week's episode of TechSnap. This has been episode 312, I do believe. 311? 311. What am I saying? I should know that by now. If you'd like to go watch the past episodes, 310, 309, they're all great. Or you'd like to see not this episode, but if you want to see the last incarnation of this show, any of the other fine Jupiter Broadcasting programs, jupiterbroadcasting.com, that's where you want to go. Plus, they've got this magical calendar widget. It will tell you when we're here live. That means you can meet us here live. You get to be a part of the show, join our wonderful IRC room, give feedback, be a part. It's a lot of fun. If you'd like to hear more from us, I'm at Wes Payne on Twitter. Dan is at TechSnap_Dan. And that concludes this program. Stay here. We'll have the latest reruns on, and we'll see you next week.